I think it was historic in the sense that it's the first time that the countries of the world acknowledge the need to transition away from fossil fuels. Establishing on the first day of the COP the new loss and damage fund was historic. But as has been the case in many past COPs, I had to say there were some good steps forward, but a lot more work to be done. It's kind of like that old Rolling Stones, you know, you can sometimes get what you need, but you won't get what you want.
COP28 was historic. For the first time ever, it was decided to address the root cause of climate change, which is the use of fossil fuels. But there's still a lot of work ahead of us. Today I talked to Alden Meyer. He's been engaged in different positions in the fight against climate change for 40 years. Welcome to Planet A, a podcast on climate change. My name is Dan Jørgensen. I'm Minister for Development Cooperation and Global Climate Policy in Denmark. In a series of conversations, I ask some of the world's leading experts, policymakers, authors, and activists how to stem climate change.
We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency.
For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear.
The reason I believe we need to act now is because the facts are staring us in the face.
The time to answer humankind's greatest challenge is now.
L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
So this gives us the best possible shot to save the one planet we've got.
There is no plan B because we do not have planet B.
Today we will be evaluating the results at COP28. To guide us through the outcomes of these negotiations, we are joined by a distinguished guest, Alden Meyer. Alden is a recognized expert and activist in climate politics with a rich history of involvement in the COP process. Having more than four decades of experience on environmental and energy issues, most recently as Director of Strategy and Policy for the Union of Concerned Scientists, he brings extensive experience to our discussion. Currently, he holds the position of Senior Associate for the climate think tank E3G. Hello, Alden, and thank you so much, my friend, for joining me here for this conversation.
It's great to be back with you again, Dan.
I think actually you're the only person that has been invited to this podcast twice.
My goodness, what an honor. I feel like I'm hosting Saturday Night Live.
But just in case one or two of our listeners don't know who you are, maybe you should start by just giving a very short introduction of your merits. You've been engaged with climate issues for more than 40 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've been working on this since I got out of college, energy and environmental issues. I've been on the climate brief since 1989 when I came to Union of Concerned Scientists to start up its climate and energy program in the United States, and I immediately dive into the international negotiations over creation of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And that was the beginning of a long and winding road over the last 30 plus years, and of course through Rio de Janeiro and the Earth Summit, the negotiation of the Kyoto Protocol, the conference in Copenhagen, of course, which triggered a whole series of follow-up actions and the Paris Agreement. So it's been quite a journey. I am now a senior associate with E3G, which is an international climate think tank headquartered in London with offices in Berlin, Brussels, and Washington. And there I'm focusing on multilateral diplomacy, not just the international climate negotiations, but the G7, the G20, US-EU diplomacy, US-China, climate working group, and a whole host of related issues.
So who better than you to answer the question? When I came back to the hotel that I stayed at in Dubai, very tired after having negotiated and not slept a lot for many, many days and nights, I took my phone and I just surfed the internet to see the headlines on newspapers all over the planet, and one word was used more than any other word, whether it was in Asia or the US or Europe or even also Africa where fortunately there's also to a larger extent focus on climate change. And that word was historic. So in your experience, do you agree that it was a historic COP? And how would you characterize it apart from that word?
Well, I think it was historic in the sense that it's the first time that the countries of the world acknowledge the need to transition away from fossil fuels, which, if you think about it, is pretty amazing that almost 30 years into this process, this is the first time we've had a commitment to transition away from fossil fuels. And as you know better than anyone, it was very hedged, very hard fought, very nuanced, a lot of loopholes. But still, it was a clear signal that we need to stop the major source of the problem, which is the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. And it's a testament to the power of the Saudis and others that they were able to prevent that discussion from happening for the previous 27 COPs. I mean, it was really only in Glasgow in 2021 at COP26 that we got the first acknowledgement of the need to phase down fossil fuels, and that was limited to coal. We couldn't extend it to cover oil and gas. So that part was historic. I think establishing on the first day of the COP the new loss and damage fund was historic. That's been an issue that I've been engaged in for over the last couple of decades. Actually, it came up at the beginning of the process when the small island states proposed inclusion of loss and damage in the Rio Framework Treaty in 1992, and we finally have a fund dedicated to helping the most vulnerable countries deal with the impacts of a problem they had almost no part in creating. So I think that was historic. But as has been the case in many past COPs, I had to say there were some good steps forward, but a lot more work to be done. And the problem, as you know, is that we're running out of time. We may be already out of time, according to the scientists, to preserve the ability to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius and avert the most devastating impacts of climate change. So that's the urgency. And these COPs never measure up to the need. It's kind of like that old Rolling Stones, you know, tune. You can sometimes get what you need, but you won't get what you want. And once again, we got what we needed. We got a placeholder and a process to build on that I know we'll talk about in this discussion going forward about really how to accelerate that transition away from fossil fuels while mobilizing more resources to help vulnerable countries deal with climate impacts.
Yeah, well, I very much agree with you that the fact that we finally managed to get a text that addresses the source of climate change, which is the burning of primarily the burning of fossil fuels, there are also other greenhouse gases. But that this happened in an oil state. We were standing there, I remember at the press conference at the end of the COP, standing in the middle of an oil state, surrounded by oil states, being able to proclaim that for the first time ever, we are now actually addressing fossil fuels, including oil and gas, was, of course, historic. What's your explanation of why it was possible for us? How could it be possible? Some people had argued that it's always been difficult, but it would be even more difficult and indeed impossible to do it now because the fact that it was an oil state, the UAE, that had the presidency.
Well, I actually was rather skeptical coming in that Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber was going to be able to pull this off. I mean, I've met with him over the course of the year. I don't know him well, but I know he's been in the game for a long time, knows a lot of the players. And I think he decided he had a personal stake in delivering this deal and that his credibility, the UAE's credibility, was on the line. And in a funny kind of way, being from an oil state, perhaps that gave him the relationships, the leverage, the ability to bring the Saudis and others around to get to accept the final outcome. And of course, as you know, he pursued an interesting strategy. The first draft he put out of the global stock take at the end of the first week was a fairly strong one, talking about the need to phase out fossil fuels, various permutations of that language, but that was basically the only option. Of course, that got fierce pushback from the Saudis, Iran, Russia, and other players saying, no, we can't commit to that. Then he, at the beginning of the second week, he put out an incredibly weak draft, which was kind of an a la carte menu saying maybe countries should think about contributing to this in various ways. And that provoked a fierce counterreaction from the U.S., the EU, the island states, the progressive Latin American community, the international NGO community. And I think that gave him the leverage to go back to the Saudis and others say, look, I put forward your version of the text. It's not going to fly. We need something stronger. And that's why they were persuaded to accept this language about transitioning away from fossil fuels in the energy sector. So he played an interesting game there. And I think it was his relationships and the UAE's credibility as a major oil and gas producer that may have allowed him to bring together this compromise at the last minute. There was a little bit of a flub there, as you know, in the closing plenary when he gaveled the agreement through while the small island states were still out of the room, discussing whether or not they wanted to accept it. And I still don't have good information about whether that was a procedural screw-up and the Secretariat hadn't informed him that a major group of countries wasn't in the room, or if he knew they weren't in the room and decided to go ahead without them anyway, which, you know, it was a pretty dramatic moment. And of course, the representative from the small island states got a sustained standing ovation after her intervention about their concerns about the limitations of the agreement. But yeah.
Including, I should add, including a standing ovation, including from the podium, which leads me to conclude that it was a mistake, that it was not a deliberate tactical step. Even so, I would also say that I very much agree with your analysis that even though it can be considered a paradox, the fact that this was in an oil state, but of course also the fact that Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber and his team really were committed and professional, and they also managed to put together a team of extremely experienced people from across the planet to help the process. The fact also, if I can say that in all modesty, that they appointed ministers to help start the process already 6 months before. So, for instance, myself and Barbara Creasy were facilitating in the talks on global stocktake from July. So we'd been doing this for months. I think all of these things combined really made the decision possible. And I think there's good reason to pay tribute to Dr. Sultan and his team for that effort.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I've advised a number of presidencies, co-presidencies over the years. And one of the central lessons I always point out to them is they need to engage your ministers early and give them responsibility and bring them into the deal. And of course, Connie Hedegaard was a master of that in 2009 in the run-up to Copenhagen. I was on her advisory committee, and she convened ministers, took them to Greenland, both to see the impacts of climate change, but even more importantly, to bond psychologically and feel like they were all in this together. Of course, your prime minister at the time had different ideas, so the outcome was a little troubling. But that's always a key strategy. I would also say that his convening of the Majlis in the middle weekend was interesting. Getting people in a circle, looking at each other directly, engaging with each other, sort of breaking down some of the formal negotiating dynamics, I think, helped lubricate the conversation. I mean, you were in the room central to that process. I'd welcome your observations. But to me, that was psychologically a little bit of a shift in the game.
Yes, it was. But I think actually the way you described it earlier, one text was, I don't think actually it was formally put forward, but it was floated. That was very ambitious. Then there was a formal text that was far from being ambitious enough. And that was really a key moment in the negotiations, because I was personally quite nervous there, because I thought, okay, if we're not able to mobilize enough pressure, then the result will be very close to this text. A very watered down text on ambitions on fossils, even though fossils was mentioned, but that would have been actually causing more damage than good, I would argue, because it would then be considered as, okay, now that's covered, but we would then never be able to get the right wording. But fortunately, we did manage, I would say, a coalition led by the EU, the US, and the island states, and then in the end, encompassing more than 130 countries, that meant that we could get the result that not 100% was equivalent to what we wanted, but a very strong text saying that we need to transition away from fossil fuels. Now, I would have liked a text saying countries has to phase down or something like that. But on the other hand, I think that when you go into negotiation, you know for a fact that you're not going to end up with the result reflecting 100% what you put on the table. That goes without saying. So I do actually think that the compromise there is a good one. I do understand people saying it's not binding enough. We would have liked stronger wording. But I would also argue, and maybe you can lend some perspective to that, Alden, that if we look back in history, quite often decisions that has been made that turned out to be extremely important, that has guided action all over the planet in the COP process, the days after and the weeks after has been criticized for not being strong enough. But because of the way the UN works, we have to remind each other that the UN is not a government. It doesn't pass decisions that Beijing then has to do or Washington then has to do. And if they don't, we will send out a UN police force to sanction it. That's not the way the UN works. So really, it is about putting pressure. It is about setting norms and international rules.
No, I totally agree with that. There's nothing the UN system or the COP can do that's going to force the U.S., China, Europe, any other country to do something they don't think is in their national interest. That's always been the case. That's why the original framework treaty in Rio was voluntary. That was largely because of my country, the United States, George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, insisting the American way of life was not negotiable and blocking any effort to have binding emission reduction targets for developed countries, which, of course, we knew at the time was going to fail. It wasn't going to be strong enough to bend the emissions curve, and that's why we negotiated the Kyoto Protocol 5 years later with binding commitments, because the experiment hadn't worked the way we had hoped it would. But this has always been a process of sort of identifying the problem, the way forward, putting pressure on countries to align their policies. Of course, transparency, reporting, visibility of efforts is key to this whole process, so that countries not only have to set pledges under the Paris Agreement, now they have to report starting this year, every other year, how they're doing in meeting them. And that, of course, provides NGOs, it provides progressive countries like Denmark, it provides the media with the ability to evaluate how countries are doing and expose those who really aren't living up to what they committed to. And we'll see how that works. It's still an experiment in progress. We don't have a central world decision-making government, despite some of the conspiracy theorists in my country and others that think we do. But that's the world we live with. And I've had this debate with a number of people, should we blow up the UNFCCC and start over? And I say no, because wherever you go next, you're going to take the same countries of the world with you. And there's no ideal forum that is going to do a better job. And the G20 doesn't have the vulnerable countries represented. You can look at the UN Security Council with the five permanent members having veto power. There's no perfect body, but the UNFCCC is the one place the world comes together each year to evaluate how we're doing, to set new directions, to create norms and expectations that I think do have an impact on policy making in most major countries.
I like to remind myself and my team sometimes when we get frustrated that things are not moving fast enough and that the decisions that are made are not ambitious enough, that if you look at the structure of this negotiation process, and if you look at how decisions are made, you could actually also argue the other way around, that it's fantastic that some decisions are made. There's more than 190 countries, and they all have a veto power. So even countries having their primary source of income in oil and gas now this year, well, last year now, but at COP28, signed an agreement to say that the world needs to transition away from where they make a living. And there are many examples of that. So I think that is one important argument that we also always need to keep in mind. Second is, if we look at how things are going, even though it is frustrating that decisions are not following what the science tells us we need to do. Still, it's not that nothing is happening. If we look at where the world were and what the tendencies were before the Paris Agreement, we were looking at a world where if nothing happened and we just proceeded with the business as usual scenario, we would have temperature increases of between 4 and 5 degrees. Now we're looking at temperature increases of below 3 degrees. That's still far from where we need to be, and it's still way too high. But it is a significant progress. Not all of this can be attributed to the fact that there is a Paris Agreement, but I'm confident that a lot of it can, because that is, as you said, the only framework where decisions are made globally, and that is what sets the norms and the targets. Take 1.5, for instance, so that we are all working to keep 1.5 in temperature increase, to keep temperature increases below that. That's not self-evident. Before Copenhagen, you mentioned COP15 in Copenhagen. There, actually, the focus was on 2 degrees. And then a group of countries, the High Ambition Coalition in Paris, managed to change that narrative, so that, and thereby also the target, so that it was below 2 degrees, well below 2 degrees, closer to 1.5. And now, with the new stronger text in Dubai, the focus is really on 1.5. So that's an example of also the science actually having found its way into the text and thereby informing and also hopefully framing decisions all over the world.
Yeah, the other hopeful sign I would point to, and Denmark's been a leader on this, is the dramatic reduction in the cost of renewable energy technologies, of energy efficiency, of LED light bulbs, of electric vehicles, et cetera. I mean, it's been a real revolution. If you look at the cost trends over the last decade, if you had told me in 2015 where we'd be now in terms of the price of solar photovoltaics or LEDs or other clean energy technologies, I would have said you're smoking something. This is crazy. No way we're going to get to those price points, but we have. Now, and that's driving a revolution and really putting wind behind the sails of the clean energy transition. Now, that's not to say we're going fast enough. We're not. We still have countries building coal plants. We still have countries, including my own, expanding natural gas production and exports. So we're doing a good job on the clean energy ramp up, and it'd be good to hear your assessment of the next steps on the renewable energy tripling and doubling of energy efficiency that we also got agreed in Dubai. But we're not doing anywhere near well enough on phasing down fossil fuels.
Well, you mentioned a very, very important point. It's not something that has been a big focus point for the media, at least not globally speaking, in Denmark probably a little bit more than other places, which is the fact that we actually managed to have a decision also on a global goal for renewables and a global goal for energy efficiency. This is fantastic, and it is something also that we obviously from Denmark has worked hard on. It was actually a couple of hundred meters from where I'm sitting right now in conference room in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Denmark last March, that we asked at the Copenhagen Climate Ministerial, which was hosted by the COP outgoing and the incoming COP presidencies in Denmark. We asked IRENA, Francesco Lagomera from IRENA, to put forward his calculations of what does it take, how much renewables do we need to deploy between now and 2030 if we are to stay below 1.5s. And this is basically where the tripling came from. That's what started the discussion, and I was quite skeptical after the first couple of hours of discussion, because too many countries around the table said that, well, it's not that we are against this, but we cannot really discuss a target like that before we have the financing. We knew that we weren't going to discuss in detail a new target for financing at COP28. That's a matter for COP29. I feared that would mean that the discussion on a global target would be kept hostage, so to speak, in the negotiations. But fortunately, it didn't. The EU also played a very constructive role in keeping the pressure on this question. And of course, when the US and China agreed on tripling this summer, when John Kerry and Xi Jinping met in California, that was really a breakthrough. So that was when I began to also believe in the possibility of getting it in the final text. But really, you didn't mention it in your first description of why the COP was historic. But I guess it's fair to say that this is also one of the results that make this COP pretty historic.
No, I think that's right. And it's kind of the flip side of the transitioning away from fossil fuels, because the only way you can do that is by accelerating the clean energy deployment. But as you say, job's not done yet. The financing is key. We'll see where that goes this year. Brazil is making this a major focus of its G20 presidency. They just put out a paper yesterday on this, on the new Clima Task Force that's going to try to integrate the finance and Sherpa tracks, which is quite promising. But it's not just financing, of course. It's critical minerals access, it's workforce development, it's grid integration and transmission access. So there's a whole lot of barriers that need to be addressed, and that probably is not the main job of the UNFCCC. It is the job of the IEA, ARENA, Clean Energy Ministerial, some of the other fora, to address some of those implementation issues and really build on the historic agreement we got in Dubai.
That is a very good point. I would even add to that that it's also the responsibility of the multilateral development banks. It's World Bank being the most important one, of course. Fortunately, the new president, Ayo Banga, has also put this at the top of his agenda. But if we don't manage to get better access to financing in the developing world for the green transition, then it cannot be done. It doesn't matter which decisions we make in a COP meeting every year. It has to be implemented. It has to actually happen. And right now, deployment, development of renewables is going very fast. So there are many positive things happening, especially in countries like China, India, and also, of course, with the IRA in the U.S., and I could also mention the EU with our Fit for 55 package that now turns out that we will actually be able to reduce by 57% instead of 55 in 2030. So all of these things are going in the right direction. But we're looking at a situation where I don't have a specific number of how many countries, but many, many countries that are not the biggest emitters now, but that will be potentially the biggest emitters in the future if we don't help them now, are not on the right track. And they're not on the right track, not because the political will is not there, not because the technology is not there, not because, this is really a paradox, the technology is more expensive than fossils. Actually, it's cheaper. The problem is, well, there's many reasons, but the main problem is the price for capital, which of course links to the fact that there's a lot of insecurity in financing project like that in many of the developing countries. So we need national governments like my own, but certainly also development banks to help de-risk investments in these transitions.
Yeah, no, I think that is key. It's not just providing and ramping up the public finance, which does need to be done, but it's also providing the right signals and guidance for the massive flows of private sector investment. And the big barrier there, as you said, is the cost of capital in developing countries outside of a few places like China. I mean, if you have to pay 15, 18, 20% interest rates on your capital for a renewable project, it's never going to pencil out and be cost effective. So we've got to address that. Again, I'm hoping the Brazilian G20 presidency will do some interesting work there. The World Bank, of course, is going forward with its evolution plan, which I think is heading in the right direction. There's work that needs to be done at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, to get it fully in the game, and the regional development banks. But the private sector capital mobilization flows is key. I mean, Mark Carney, you'll remember at COP26 in Glasgow, famously said there's $130 trillion of capital ready to engage and be put into this fight. But of course, we've not seen that mobilized at anywhere near the scale. It's all the incentives and the tax codes and the financial guidance. I think the financial transition planning, the disclosure requirements, is putting pressure on some of these private sector actors to align their investment portfolios with 1.5. And partly it's because they're recognizing that if we're in a 3-degree world, the value of their investments is affected by climate impacts, and their markets are being affected by climate impacts and the need for many of these countries to divert resources away from investment in their products and services into basically climate disaster and responding to climate emergencies. So there's a lot of good things going on, but as we talked about earlier, it's not happening fast enough.
No, and we've focused our talk now on, well, a little bit about loss and damage, but primarily on mitigation, where I think it's necessary that we all acknowledge that climate change is not something that might happen in the future. It's here now, and many countries are affected severely already now. In my own portfolio as a minister, I'm also a minister for development cooperation, so not only global climate policy, which means that we're trying to have a holistic approach from the Danish side, and I can say that in all of the countries that we work with in Africa and elsewhere, developing countries, what's happening is that the issues and challenges that they face are being worsened, multiplied by climate change. Whether it's poverty, lack of education, conflicts, they're being multiplied as we speak by climate change. Some countries it's droughts, other countries it's flooding, extreme heat that makes it impossible for a country to function some months of the year, things like that. And if we don't, as a world community, step up to that challenge, helping countries become more resilient and adapt, the consequences will be catastrophic. And we talked about the challenges in finding and mobilizing finance for mitigation efforts, and that's even where there's a good business case, that's even where there's money to be made for the investors. In adaptation measures, very often there's no money to be made and there's no good business case. It's about helping a country. It's something you need to do for idealistic reasons. This means, of course, then also that it's difficult to get private financing, so you need governments to step up. You need the world's richest countries in general to follow the recommendations by the UN to pay 0.7% of their GDP to development aid. But even if that happened, we would not have enough money. So I don't know, Alden, what's your opinion on this? How do we solve this problem? How do we make sure that the huge need for more financing of adaptation efforts in developing worlds are met?
Well, it is a challenge. We do have the agreement in Glasgow that developed countries made to double adaptation finance by next year, to $40 billion a year. There was an update from Germany and Canada on the progress that's being made on that front, but we're not there yet, just like we did not reach the $100 billion 2020 goal that we had set in Copenhagen for mobilizing overall climate finance. So there's more work to be done on that front, but we have to go beyond that and leverage the multilateral development bank finance, try to provide incentives for private sector investment. I mean, you're right, there's not the business case in all sectors of adaptation that there is for mitigation, but there is in some sectors, in agriculture, in engineering, water system infrastructure and supply. There's a number of areas where it's cost effective and there's money to be made and jobs to be created. But also, and Mia Motley points this out from Barbados, the prime minister, every dollar we invest in climate resilience saves us $7 or $8 that we would have to pay later for loss and damage. So there's not just a moral case, there's a business case to be made here for countries, developed countries in particular, that if we don't help developing countries build their resilience to climate impacts, we're going to have to pay later in terms of loss and damage when they suffer catastrophic impacts. So, you know, it is a challenge. We did get some signals there out of Dubai on the road forward on that with the global goal on adaptation and adaptation finance, but I think that's going to be a major challenge for the next two presidencies to take forward. In addition to the implementation, the energy transition is really addressing that side of the equation.
And I would also say that even though it's, for me, it's clear that this COP in many ways was a success and it did bring us to, in many senses, a new and better place, for reasons that we have talked about. I do think that on the adaptation agenda, this is where we the result simply wasn't good enough. We should have made decisions that would have made it more credible that we actually take as a global community these challenges serious. This is also why our friends in many of the island states that you referred to earlier in our talk were so disappointed at the end of the COP, because they had also fought, of course, for the good results that we got on fossils and other areas, but they were very disappointed that on the issue that means maybe the most for them, which is how do we help them adapt so that they have a chance of surviving as nations. This is what it's about for them. It's about survival.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's not just the small islands. I heard this from the African group. I heard this from some of the Latin American countries, other countries in Asia. This is a universal problem. I mean, climate is affecting everyone. It's affecting the U.S., it's affecting Europe, it's affecting China. The difference is those three countries or regions have the capacity and the financial capital to deal with the impacts in their countries, where countries in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, small islands, others don't. So I think this is, and this isn't something that's entirely on the UNFCCC. I think there's other arenas. You've been involved in the Climate and Development Ministerial, the UK and Rwanda led over the last couple of years. There's the G20. There's some other UN spaces, the Summit for the Future next September in New York. I think there's a number of spaces where this needs to be addressed. And we, as you say, we need to have a much more robust strategy and financing package for adaptation coming out of the next couple of COPs than we did out of Dubai.
Yes, we certainly do. Now, Alden, you're also an expert in diplomacy as I would even say as a trade, I guess you could say, right? Would you characterize yourself as a diplomat?
I spend a lot of time with diplomats and trying to influence diplomats. I put it that way. I'm kind of an influencer, but as I said at the beginning, I've been involved in the climate diplomacy game since the very beginning. Actually, one of the first stories was at one of the founding meetings for the IPCC in Sundsvall, Sweden. The Brazilian delegation was threatening to kill the IPCC because they saw it as a threat to the sovereignty over the Amazon. And we had to call the new environment minister, José Goldenberg, in Brasilia in the middle of the night from Sweden, wake him up and get him to give his team better negotiating instructions, or we were going to blow the whistle with the international media. And so, this has been this kind of high wire act since the beginning because of the perception that somehow this UN bureaucracy or the IPCC or someone else is trying to come in and impose their will on you. There's always this perception of sovereignty and national control and self-interest that comes in. So that's part of the challenge here, is getting past that mindset. I've often said that, if we could change the culture of the negotiations away from the blame-casting and finger-pointing kind of your end of the lifeboat is sinking metaphor to the kind of radical collaboration we see among states and cities and provinces and some businesses where they really try to help each other learn from experiences and collaborate to advance climate ambition. If we could get that culture transfusion somehow into the UNFCCC negotiators, we'd be ahead of the game. My old friend Andre de Lago, who was the lead negotiator from Brazil for a number of years and now has been actually asked by President Lula to chair this G20 climate task force, famously joked that he said, "What's the difference between the Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Convention on Biological Diversity?" And he said, "Well, the Convention on Biological Diversity is about ecosystems. The Framework Convention on Climate Change is about egosystems." And so if we could get a different negotiating culture here, we're all in the same boat. We have to solve this together. Let's not find each other's soft and sore points and poke at them. Let's figure out how to support each other and collaborate to get a better result. That would in some ways be the most important innovation we could make.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because for you and I that's been working in this field for many years, even for us it's difficult to describe what actually goes on in a COP because it's so complex and so many actors have influence on so many different levels. And I wanted to ask you if you could comment on one of the ways that my own country and others try to make a difference, which is not a part of the actual negotiations, but still, which is the alliances that we make, where the most important one that Denmark has created is beyond the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance. We were extremely proud when one of the leading climate media during the COP in the end game last couple of days, they wrote as a headline of one of their articles, now it's OPEC versus BOGA. Now BOGA is just an alliance of COP20-something countries and subnational states that has agreed that we need to move away from oil and gas. And my own country, we've set an end date on the production of oil and gas and cancelled our future state licensing rounds. Other countries have done similar things and are part of this this alliance. So I'm not trying to exaggerate our role, and probably that headline was a bit of an exaggeration, but it described that actually a group of countries taking the lead on a specific issue can set an agenda and can be a part of putting pressure on other actors. So, for instance, for me, it was also almost a little bit schizophrenic sometimes in the negotiations, because I had the role of being the facilitator together with Barbara Creasy on the Global Stocktake on behalf of the presidency. So basically being objective and neutral in that role. On the other hand, I was also a part of the European Union delegation, which of course we put pressure on the process to have as ambitious a result as possible. And I was also the head of the BOGA Alliance, which of course focused on the need to have a strong text on fossils. And when I can even hear when I describe it, it sounds like almost an impossible task. And surely some of the people that I was negotiating with would find it difficult to see me as an objective, neutral facilitator in one room, but a fierce proponent for something else in a different room. But in reality, it works very well. And there's an understanding between negotiators that this is the way things work. And by the way, I haven't even then mentioned the role of NGOs, experts like yourself, Alden, that are also even sometimes standing physically right outside of the negotiation room so that we, the negotiators, can go out and ask you for advice. This is also, I mean, there's a lot of focus on lobbyism as a negative thing, and to some extent I agree with the criticism, but there's not a lot of focus on this, which is really fantastic, that it's possible to negotiate on those very different levels with so many actors being involved.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the role of alliances and groups like BOGA is essential. You mentioned the 1.5 in Paris. That really started with Tony de Brum of the Marshall Islands and going out and recruiting people into the High Ambition Coalition to fight for that goal. No one thought that was possible at the beginning of Paris, the beginning of the 2 weeks, that we could get a commitment to aim for 1.5. But that High Ambition Coalition really did create the dynamic that got there. BOGA is an important club. The Climate and Development Ministerial that I mentioned earlier is an important space. We'll see where the climate club that Germany and Chile are leading goes now. Maybe that's a space where we can deconflict some of the trade-related disputes over carbon border adjustments and the industrial sector transition. So these sort of non-formal negotiating groups are very essential. And the NGOs often play a critical role too, because we can operate sort of outside the boundaries of the game of government negotiators. I'll give you just one example. In 2012, in the COP in Doha, Qatar, in the end game, there was a huge fight between the U.S. and the small island states over the loss and damage issue and the loss and damage language. And the head of the U.S. Negotiating team was threatening to basically collapse the entire talks if this wasn't resolved to the U.S.'s liking. And there was a small group of NGOs, myself, Jennifer Morgan, Sven Harmling from CARE at the time, Salim El-Hook, unfortunately, passed away last year, but was a force of nature on loss and damage and climate impacts. And we did shuttle diplomacy through the closing night into the early morning hours of the last Saturday in Doha, working out an understanding between the U.S. and IOSIS on some language they could both live with. And of course, the way they could both live with it was to interpret it as to mean exactly the opposite thing. As often happens in diplomacy, wording and language is key. And sometimes even placement of commas is key, as we found out in the end game in the loss and damage negotiations this year. So NGOs do play a critical role. You know, we cooperate. We do have radical collaboration through groups like the Climate Action Network and others, and we crowdsource our intelligence. We often know more about what's actually going on across the whole negotiations than almost anyone, maybe with the exception of the Secretariat team, and we're able to put that to good advantage to go to countries and say, you ought to be talking to so-and-so, or have you thought about, you know, this approach or whatever. So we're not formal negotiators, but we're near negotiators, and we can help lubricate the process and get people to agreements that they might not have been able to reach without that help from the outside. And of course, then there's also the moral impact we can have working through the media, working through advocacy, working through demonstrations and protests and civil society actions to build pressure from the outside on negotiators.
Yes, I can definitely testify to that. I guess it's fair that I say this. I mean, there's nothing to hide, but the way it works is that there'll be almost like strategy meetings between negotiators and ministers and NGOs, and those meetings might sometimes result in a decision to deploy certain tactics, which, for instance, could be: should a certain group of countries threaten to walk out of the negotiations? And if they do so, would they then get the support from the NGOs and the civil society? And would that then put pressure on negotiators? That has been known to happen, and it's also been known to be extremely effective. So I do really think that NGOs play a very important part. I would also say I'm very fortunate that I have my own team of very experienced people that can advise me, but some countries are not that fortunate. So especially developing countries, maybe they don't really have a lot of capacity, which is a problem in these complex negotiations. So very often NGOs help. Sometimes they even fund advisors that then sit next to the negotiators in the negotiation rooms. Other times they do it in a less formal way, but it's very clear that the knowledge, the know-how, the network of the NGO community, it really helps, especially many of the more vulnerable and maybe not so wealthy countries on the planet.
Yeah, no, that's certainly the case. And that was the case early on in the negotiations with the small island states, who got a lot of help from a number of international legal advisors from the UK, from Europe, from the US and elsewhere that helped them put together their strategies. And I think that is a challenge of capacity and the ability of some of these countries to really cover the full gamut of the negotiations and have the impact they need to have. It's also, you know, a limitation sometimes for the presidencies. I mean, the next presidency, Azerbaijan, doesn't have the capacity that the UAE did, for example, or the level of experience in the game that Dr. Al-Jaber had. So this is an issue that's always been, the case, and often you do see collaboration even at the formal level. When Fiji had the presidency in 2017, for example, the EU provided a lot of support, you know, to Fiji in terms of how to run the process and get the results that were needed.
So, Alden, before our talk here, I had a meeting with my team. We're finalizing now our strategy for the next year, because you don't get, in this game, you don't get a lot of time to rest on your laurels. We had a few weeks of a break after the COP28, but then we started preparing for COP29, of course, and now already we more or less know which direction we're moving and definitely what we need to do first. But I would be very interested to hear you, and I'm sure the listeners would also give your evaluation of what needs to be the focus now moving on towards COP29, also, of course, knowing that this is to some extent also a preparation to COP30 in Belém in Brazil, which will be one of the more important COPs, because this is where COP30, where countries need to deliver new pledges, new NDCs.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of fronts. We've talked about some of them. One, for example, is providing support to countries to align their next round of pledges under Paris that are due early next year with the 1.5 degree C target. That's both technical assistance, it's finance and investment planning transition planning assistance. The transition away from fossil fuels, as you know, as the co-chair of BOGA, is essential as well. We heard complaints from countries like Colombia that's making a commitment to shift away from basing its economy on fossil fuel production, and that they're getting penalized in the capital markets. The bond rating agencies are downgrading their credit rating, and they're having harder time in paying higher interest rates for investment because they've made this decision, responsible decision, to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy. So we need, also a member of BOGA, and we need strategies to help those countries figure out how they're going to make their transition. I mean, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, they've got all the money they need to finance their own transition, but that's not the case with Colombia or Nigeria or Ecuador, which is ramping up oil production right now to, you know, service unsustainable debt loads. So that's a big thing, I think. There's a lot of work, as we talked about earlier, needed in implementing the renewable energy tripling, energy efficiency doubling. Energy efficiency in particular gets a little less attention than renewables, but if you don't do the fundamental blocking and tackling to increase the efficiency of energy use, we're not going to get where we need to get to just with tripling renewables, so that's essential. The whole area of financial reform, international governance, this is a priority for the Brazilian G20, which is going to be quite important, I think. It goes beyond the World Bank and the IMF to looking at the whole way we make governance decisions, the role of the central banks, the role of the finance ministries, the role of the private sector credit rating agencies and others. So that needs to be reformed. And that goes beyond climate, of course. That's debt relief. That's all the sustainable development goals. That's unlocking prosperity and growth for these countries. So they're not juggling these multiple competing crises, the so-called polycrisis, as people have referred to, of food security and inflation and debt and climate and pandemics, et cetera. And as we discussed, we need a much more aggressive and forceful approach to adaptation and loss and damage, particularly on financing, but also capacity development and support for these countries to do the planning and the work that they need. So there's a lot of work to be done here. Denmark is in a central role, hosting the Copenhagen Climate Ministerial, leading BOGA, advising the G20 as an invited participant in some of these discussions. So you really can make a difference here on a number of these fronts. But it's a daunting agenda. And, you know, we do have to look at it in a multi-year frame, I think, looking out to Belém in late 2025 with the Brazilian COP, even looking in the G20 beyond Brazil to South Africa and then the U.S. in 2026, looking at what the G7 can do, looking at what the U.N. system can do with the Summit of the Future next year and other things. There's talk maybe the Secretary General would convene a special pledging session early in 2025 where countries like the U.S. and China and Europe and others could bring forward their new pledges under Paris and build some political pressure for ambition. So there's a lot of work to be done, but that's why we get the big bucks, right, Dan?
That's true. Well, thank you so much for that. I agree with everything you said. A lot of work ahead of us. Alden, are you, having worked with this for 40 years, you also read almost every week new reports from the science telling us that things are moving in the... When we look at what's actually happening with the climate and the effects it has, it turns out that it's probably even worse than we thought, you know? It's very rare that you get a report saying, okay, so on this parameter, it isn't as bad as we thought. It's almost always the opposite. So sometimes when I get stuck in those reports, I can get a little bit depressed. So it's good to have the possibility, of course, to try and do a real difference from a political perspective. But then when that's going too slow, this is where you really need to stay optimistic. And sometimes it's difficult. So my question to you, do you manage to stay optimistic? Do you believe that we do have a chance of staying below 1.5 degrees?
Well, those are different questions. I mean, I do have to balance hope and grief in this job, as you say. We've talked about some of the reasons for hope, but as you say, there's a lot of reasons for grief, and you have to avoid that falling into despair and giving up. and resignation, because then you're basically not effective. So it is a balancing act psychologically and emotionally. 1.5 is it's increasingly difficult to lay a credible path that even though we have the technologies and even though they are cost effective, we don't see anywhere near the level of ambition and policy and deployment and incentives to get them in place quickly enough. Most scientists will now say it's almost certain that we're going to overshoot 1.5. And the question is, can we limit the magnitude and the duration of that overshoot and get down below 1.5 as quickly as possible again? So, you know, these are tough issues, and it is the future of our children, our grandchildren, other generations at stake here. So it can get quite challenging, and at quiet times you do have to grieve a little bit and say, is there more we could have done? And certainly there is more we could have done over the last 30 years to not be in the position that we are now, but that's where we are. And my attitude is, as long as I can, I'm going to keep fighting to get as much ambition out of the system as I can, and that's the best I can do. And then I'll turn it over to the next generation of youth activists that are coming in, which is one other thing that gives me hope, frankly, is the youth coming in a very powerful way.
And thank you so much for doing that, Alden, and having done it for so many years. We also now, of course, 2024, are looking at a year that I think is the year in history ever where most people will have to cast their vote. I think it's the year ever in the history of the planet with most democratic elections. Well, with most people voting at democratic elections, because it's also about which countries and how big these countries are. And of course, this, again, that can go both ways, right? All right. Optimism, because in more and more countries, climate change is a part of the agenda and will be a part of what's being discussed. The U.S. is one of those countries. 10 years ago, it wasn't on the agenda in the election. Many places in the world where it is now, and U.S. is one of them. On the other hand, the U.S. did have a president before the one you have now that pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, and we'll see similar important elections other places on the planet. Just to end our discussion here today, Alden, how do you look at this situation with all of these elections, and do you think climate change will be high on the agenda in most countries or not?
Well, there are a number of important elections, not just the U.S., the European parliamentary elections, but South Africa, India, a number of major developing countries. And I think the challenge is to frame climate as an opportunity, not as a threat to economic prosperity and development, but actually as key to it, that if we don't deal with climate change, we're not going to get what people want in their countries. And if we do accelerate the climate ambition, it actually can advance the prosperity agenda, the sustainability agenda, the equity agenda. And that's tough. I mean, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation campaigns including funded by the fossil fuel industry over the last 30 years, as my previous group, the Union of Concerned Scientists and others, have documented. So it's a very challenging space, but there's a lot of work going on to try to frame climate ambition in a way that it can be seen as helpful to leaders that are running for election or re-election in their countries as a platform. But it's not easy, and it does have a lot of pitfalls, and if done wrong, climate policy can open politicians up to attack from their opponents, as we've seen in a number of countries. So, you know, it is work in progress, and we do have to keep a close eye on what happens. And of course, there's no doubt if Trump was reelected president in this country, you'd see a radically different policy at the federal level on climate than you have under the Biden administration. You'd still see a lot of progress in the states and in the cities and in this business community. The momentum of the Inflation Reduction Act and the tax incentives there is really leading to a fundamental shift in investment patterns and the facts on the ground. But it would not be supported by the next administration if it was a Trump presidency. There's no doubt about that. So the world's got to think about that and think what it would do if that happened. But at the same time, keep your eye on the ball. And keep doing the work at the ministerial level and the negotiations and the other spaces to try to create the right environment.
We certainly will. Alden, thank you so much for this, and thank you for all the hard work that you're doing.
Well, thanks to you, Dan, and look forward to working with you going forward over these next couple of years.
You've listened to Planet A, a podcast on climate change and what to do about it.